for years and years and years when we were kids, I've got a younger brother and younger sister, my dad made us popcorn. It was like his thing. He never cooked us dinner or, you know, lunch, but he'd cook popcorn. And he always made us popcorn. And so every year he used to go to the US on business. And in the US, popcorn was and still is a much bigger industry than it is in the UK. And he'd bring back popcorn for us as presents. And there was one year where he brought back a ridiculous quantity and said, no, I need to make my own now. This is crazy. I'm going to try and make a better popcorn than what I've tried.
Leave aside any preconceptions you might have about multiplex popcorn. We're visiting the kitchen behind some of the fanciest film fare you're ever likely to munch today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
It's a really interesting, symbolic, heavily loaded piece of clothing. It's a cage, and the woman sits in the middle of the cage.
Costume designer Holly Waddington takes us inside the wardrobe of this year's devilish thriller, Lady Macbeth, and we'll pick our top five favourite movie costumes. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Have you ever wondered why we always seem to turn to popcorn during a trip to the movies? The delicious buttery snack has held pride of place at the candy bar for longer than anyone can remember. But if you're anything like me, you've probably grown wary of those suspicious popcorn purveyors, offering rubbery blobs awaft with the taste of last week. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. In the age of streaming, cinemas are increasingly on the lookout for new ways to entice people away from the small screen. Joe and Sefs are the popcorn wizards behind such flavours as French goat's cheese and Malabar black pepper, caramel and Belgian chocolate, and for the British breakfast connoisseur, Marmite. Monocle's Yolene Goffin took a Willy Wonka-inspired trip to Joe and Sefs' kitchen to find out how it's all made.
No trip to the movies would be complete without the delicious aroma of buttery popcorn. But where did this Moorish movie time treat come from? Back in the roaring 20s, in the glorious days of the luxurious and gilded theatres, visitors were not allowed to eat inside like we are today. Sticky sweet crumbles from peanuts and popcorn would, of course, ruin those crimson rugs and velvet seats. But at the height of the Great Depression in the 1930s, while many other businesses closed down, small popcorn vendors thrived. Popcorn was inexpensive to make, which made a bag of the snack an affordable luxury. And then, of course, even during a time of withdrawal, there was its smell of melted butter, which was just irresistible. Struggling movie theatres took note and started installing popcorn machines inside their lobbies, with revenues soon skyrocketing. No one cared about hoovering those rugs that little extra. In other words, popcorn saved the movie theatre industry from near collapse during the Great Depression. And after that, advertising did the rest.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Today, the beloved theatre snack still hasn't lost his appeal, so I decided to have a look behind the scenes of the popcorn chefs. Joe and Zeffs is a family-run business of gourmet popcorn makers based here in London, and they were so kind to give me a caramelised scented popcorn tour. A dream come true.
I'm Adam, co-founder of Joe and Zeffs Popcorn. for years and years and years, when we were kids, I've got a younger brother and younger sister, my dad made us popcorn. It was like his thing. He never cooked us dinner or, you know, lunch, but he'd cook popcorn. And he always made us popcorn. So every year he used to go to the US on business. And in the US, popcorn was and still is a much bigger industry than it is in the UK. And he'd bring back popcorn for us as presents. And there was one year where he brought back a ridiculous quantity and said, no, I need to make my own now. This is crazy. I'm going to try and make a better popcorn than what I've tried. And that was it. So it started when we were really young. He tried to make this different popcorn to what he'd tried, and but much more British in the way that we made it. So using natural flavours instead of artificial, using hot air to pop the corn instead of oil, lots of different things like that. And that was it. And 6 years ago, at the end of 2010, we went, oh, and these recipes are really good. And my dad had retired and I was a bit bored in the job I was doing. My mum was really keen to do something. We thought, let's just go and see what people think. Took it to a food show and that was it. It went mad and people absolutely went crazy for the popcorn. And that was the start of Joe and Seth's. So what's going on here? We've got our mushroom kernels of popcorn, which is like the variety of corn that we use, is going in the top of the machine. It's being heated at a really, really hot temperature just by hot air. And the result of it is that the popcorn kernel pops on its own without the need for any oil. And at the end, you can hear and see all of the different popcorn kernels coming out, big whole pieces of our mushroom-shaped popcorn. And with none of those annoying small bits that you'd get in most varieties of popcorn, because you can see multiple occasions we're sieving out all the small pieces. All the ones that haven't quite popped as large as we'd like, to the size that we want, they're sieving those out. The popcorn's then coming out into this big bag where it then will get sieved again by another person to make sure that there is only the biggest pieces of corn left. I mentioned the mushroom variety of corn that we use, and that size is really, really big, and it means that we can get a really great premium coated popcorn, whilst other popcorns we'll use kind of popcorns with wings, which look like butterflies, we will use a much larger corn, the mushroom corn. Once we've got the popcorn made, we then merge it with our caramel sauce. So the caramel sauce is pretty much coated on top of the popcorn. We then put it in the oven for a secret amount of time at a secret temperature, and it will then be cooled on our cooling tables by some of these guys who are trained pastry chefs, and they'll treat the popcorn like a piece of pastry and make sure that every single piece is fully coated and cools down with that perfect crunch that you want from the popcorn. We have a range of over 40 flavours and they're all made in this room. Obviously the ones with nuts are kept separate from the ones without nuts because we have to be careful of allergens. All the different flavours are made in here. So at the moment we're making our famous gin and tonic popcorn is coming off those tables there. We're making some new very secret test flavours on that table there. Over there the lady's weighing up all the different ingredients for tomorrow morning's production so that they're ready when they come in tomorrow morning to produce all of those different flavours. And most of the rest of the tables will be taken up with our salted caramel popcorn, which is still our bestseller. So this is like our brand new caramelizer. It's only just arrived. It's the first time I've actually seen it. And you can see the caramel is... So we use only the finest English butter, really great British sugar, and all of the things combined to make this amazing smelling caramel sauce. And depending on the flavour that we're then going to make of the popcorn afterwards, it will then be infused with the gin and tonic. So real gin, real tonic water, apple, flavour, cinnamon, all real natural ingredients, and it'll all go into this machine. It smells good, doesn't it?
It smells amazing. Do you ever get sick of the smell?
No, I can eat popcorn all day long. It's really, really good. Although I must just stop them because it's boiling over. Guys, it's boiling over. When we first launched Joe and Seth's, we stood there and people came up to the stand going, what have you done with popcorn? I just want salt or sweet. You know, that was it. That was the expectation of what you would get. And you would only ever eat it in a cinema. And we were there standing there with chili popcorn, goat's cheese popcorn, you know, and latterly flavours like gin and tonic popcorn and Marmite popcorn. So we very much sort of turned on its head what kind of consumers had been expecting. We now have a range of 40 flavours of popcorn and also more recently a range of 10 flavours of caramel sauces as well, which we've launched, which is the caramel that coats our popcorn. We've bottled it for people to use as toppings on cupcakes and in baking or just eat from the spoon like I do. If I could somehow put an oven in the bottom of the bag of popcorn to get that smell coming out of the bag, and it would be a sort of dreamy scenario. But certainly when you open a bag of Joe and Seth's, because it's so strongly flavoured, you get that whiff of whatever the flavour might be, the salted caramel or cheese on toast, which is my personal favourite. Film for us is obviously a massive area because popcorn and movies is just perfect combinations. We have a number of awesome customers who supported us over the years, including Picture House Cinemas, who have some great locations across London in particular. So we love to do stuff with people like that, but also with specific titles. So for the BFG movie that came out last year, Steven Spielberg movie, we created a Frob's Got All Popcorn with a really cool artwork logo, which Steven Spielberg himself signed off. Not that I ever got to see the autographed copy. I'm desperately still trying to get hold of that, but he had to sign off the artwork himself before we could print it. We've made a few, well, I think there were successes, but just everyone else didn't. The first flavour that just wasn't very well received, and I still don't really know why, it was our banoffee pie popcorn. We created it because banoffee pie is my favourite thing in the whole world, but for some reason, everyone else didn't think so. So that one didn't really succeed, although I'm convinced we should bring it back again soon. The other flavour that's quite funny, we made a bit of a mistake once in the kitchens when we were making our really popular cheese on toast popcorn and also making a strawberries and cream popcorn. The kitchens got a bit confused and put the strawberries in the cheese on toast. So we had a strawberry cheese on toast popcorn. And so we had about 4 or 5 kilos of this popcorn. It was a small batch at the time to sell. And we took it to this food show and we thought, well, let's just give some samples. We'll let everyone try it and enjoy it. There was one customer who tried it, came back at the end of the show and said, this is my favourite popcorn ever. How much of it can I buy? And we're like, well, we've got 5 kilos actually. All right, great, great. So we bought 5 kilos. We were over the moon, like, thank God we got rid of that popcorn. Every month, this customer still emails and goes, are you bringing the strawberries and cheese on toast popcorn back? It's my favourite flavour. I don't like any of the other flavours. So it's really bizarre. The flavours that you try not to create end up being a success, and the flavours that you try to make a success sometimes don't quite end up being that way. We are starting to send it to the US. We've got some amazing customers over there, including an airline, a large hotel group, and some amazing stores in New York as well that we supply. So, yeah, it's kind of like the Coles to Newcastle story, really, of that was selling popcorn back to the home of popcorn.
So, once a working-class treat, bringing relief during a time of crises, popcorn is now firmly established as the snack time standard for any luxury cinema experience. And with modern audiences demanding far more than the old stale multiplex fare, the candy bar may just be on the brink of its very own golden age. Which, for a sweet tooth like me, for Monocle, I'm Yolene Goffin.
Thanks, Yolene. Well, needless to say, there has been quite a bit of popcorn consumed at Midori House this week. Still to come, we will speak to the costume designer of this year's devilish thriller, Lady Macbeth. But first, a look at what else is happening in the movie press. Continuing our theme from last week's show, news emerged this week of Comcast possibly joining forces with Apple and Amazon to create a premium video on demand service. The Hollywood Reporter suggests that the new service could offer movies for home viewing about 30 days after their release in theaters, with rental prices starting at $30. Now, if that seems a little steep, consider the predicament of the average family staring down a cinema ticket price of between $10 and $15 each in the US, or up to £20 here in the UK. But one studio executive was quoted saying there was no chance of the platform taking shape without at least three big studios on board. Stay tuned. In other news, the comedy world is in mourning this week after Jerry Lewis passed away at the age of 91. Many considered him to be the king of comedy, starring to great acclaim in films such as the original version of The Nutty Professor in 1963 and his many collaborations with Dean Martin, including in 1953 Scared Stiff, co-starring my favourite actress, Elizabeth Scott. The Cinema Show is, of course, brought to you in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. Streaming this week are two films by the French filmmaker Arnaud Desplechin: the dark comedy My Sex Life, or How I Got Into an Argument, and the director's second film La Sentinelle, which recalls the unexpected story of a medical intern whisked away on a strange journey of international intrigue after discovering a shrunken head in his luggage. Sample a whole month of MUBI for free. Head to MUBI.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. When concocting a whole world on the screen, many filmmakers call upon an extensive recipe book. Set designers toil away on manufacturing a backdrop, while the props department ensures that the right objects are at an arm's reach. For a costume designer, however, the challenge is rather more physical. The protagonists of the film will, quite literally, be wearing their creations. So what does it take to make actors look authentic on the screen? Lady Macbeth is the debut feature by British theatre director William Oldroyd. The film's setting of rural England in 1865 demanded pristine attention to detail. Ahead of its home release, Monocle contributor Maria Granina sat down with the costume designer Holly Waddington to discover the secrets of creating 1800s attire for the modern screen.
The research is a really key and significant part of the job. So on a film like Lady Macbeth, for example, I would do a lot of historical research into the period. The film was at the beginning of photography, so I had some really interesting photographic references, actually references of the north of England, just, you know, country towns in Cumbria and Northumberland, which were my sort of starting points. And then I would research around that. I used a lot of libraries and the V&A Library and the British Library. And most costume designers are avid collectors of photography books and of paintings. And that's a really joyous part of the process, actually, delving into the past and gathering sources. And for me, I like to make big boards, and I think for a lot of other costume designers too, and cover the walls in lots and lots of imagery. And then for me, it's a process of distilling it down and taking things away until you've got the sort of a distilled collection of imagery that feels really important in creating the look of the film.
In your recent work for Lady Macbeth, costumes play such an important role in creating that claustrophobic world around Catherine. Like, even that dress, her signature cobalt blue dress with a brooch pinned at the neck, there are so many shots where she sits still and, like, the folds don't move. Tell me about this dress. It is so significant.
Yes. The period in which the film is set is the period, it's the 1860s, isn't it? It's when the crinoline cage was really fashionable. It's a really interesting, symbolic, heavily loaded piece of clothing. It's a cage, and the woman sits in the middle of the cage. The purpose of it was to, prior to the crinoline being invented, women wore many petticoats, and the fashion just got for more and more and more petticoats until it became so heavy and so cumbersome. So actually the crinoline was in some ways a liberating garment, because it was a simple steel cage that created the shape, so it's suddenly that the woman was liberated from wearing heavy layers. But in terms of its image, it's actually a cage. It was a really strong, poetic motif, actually, for our story, because Catherine is trapped in this marriage, very unhappy marriage, in a very isolated part of the country, in remote, rural Northumberland. And the cage was just a really fantastic symbol, I guess, of her predicament. Even though, as I was telling you, that the crinoline actually was a way of liberating women from wearing millions of petticoats. But also, I think it's a very interesting period in the history of costume. The woman, that even the way that those dresses are cut, they really, you mentioned the brooch at the neck, they're very modest in some ways. They come right up to the neck, apart from the evening wear, which is very different, but we didn't do any evening wear. They sort of encase the upper body. The arms are very sloping. You know, the way the shoulder seams are cut, it almost forced the shoulders into a kind of rounded shape. These dresses are cut is very sort of body forming, but in a way that kind of forces a certain sort of timidness or meekness. They're not at all liberating in the way that the woman can move. Similarly, the bonnets that were very fashionable, which we didn't use many bonnets in our film, only at the beginning in the wedding scene. They kind of force the wearer to only see in one direction. You know, there's this sense that, you know, the woman, that the wearer is really sort of the victim, you know, this is one reading, the victim of the patriarchal world in which those clothes were set.
There is another dress, the orange dress that Catherine wears when she meets Sebastian in Lamba. Yeah, and there is a powerful scene when Anna takes her dress from the floor after their first night. I wonder, I've noticed in this film, she meets Sebastian in this dress and never her husband. What is this dress? Is it more open? Was it a night dress?
Yes, so that was something that we made up. Or it was actually the idea of it was exactly as you described. It was a much more liberated, much more sensual, sexier dress. It's really based on the idea of a nightgown or dressing gown. There's a looseness and a sensuality to that garment that I wanted for Catherine in those scenes with Sebastian that's completely at odds with how she dresses when she's at home, and certainly with her husband when she's wearing a high-buttoned, modest, white nightie.
And can you open a curtain for me and tell me, like, how the actual garments were created for the film? Were they sourced from somewhere, or were they created from scratch? And what influenced the decisions of choosing a texture, like a colour and a fabric?
Some of the costumes were made from scratch, and mainly they were Catherine's wardrobe. So we didn't have a lot of money for this film. It's made on a very small budget. So we decided to, first of all, keep everybody's wardrobes really minimal, and everybody has a very small wardrobe. Catherine has a few dresses, and most of those things were made. Some things are hired, and I sourced them here in London and also in Paris, because at the time that we made the film, there were so many 19th century productions happening here in England that I had to go to Paris because there just wasn't anything available to rent. So she does have one dress which was hired. It's a green dress which she wears to poison Boris. Within those daguerreotypes, you get a lot of different shades of black. So you get purpley blacks, oily, greeny blacks. And this is something I really wanted to embrace. And it's sort of like the iridescence that you get on a crow's wing or within a crow's feathers. Or on oil, you know, those kind of iridescent colours within the palette, within a spectrum of blacks. I wanted to kind of go for those. And so the men are all pretty much in black and white. There's a sort of puritanicalness to the colour palette of the whole film. All the maids and all the two maids, they wear sort of aubergine black dresses throughout the film. And I wanted Catherine's colours to really come out of that spectrum. So she wears quite toxic blue as her main coloured dress. And then she has a very vivid greeny, sort of two-tony green. It's a great period of shot taffeta, shot silk, where you weave one colour with another coloured silk, so it sort of flashes in different, to create different colours. Yeah, so there's a sort of toxic, striking palette to her wardrobe. And then that pink dressing gown is just a sort of, I suppose, an antidote to that. It's a soft colour that complements skin very nicely, and under candlelight in those bedroom scenes, it sort of offers another perspective.
Maria Granina with costume designer Holly Waddington. Since the dawn of cinema, we've been treated to some spectacular examples of ingenious design. Well, let's take a look at five of our favourites. At fifth place, Edward Scissorhands. Director Tim Burton's deeply personal project released the year following the explosive success of Batman. Costume designer Colleen Atwood devised the outfit worn by Johnny Depp in the title role from pieces of leather, vinyl, and latex, with buckles, bolts, and belts added later. The result was something reminiscent of a 19th century mechanical man, though still unmistakably human.
The light concealing cream goes on first. Then you blend and blend and blend. Blending is the secret.
Atwood remains a frequent collaborator of Burton's, having designed again for Depp in the 1994 film Ed Wood and 1999's Sleepy Hollow. In fourth place, Woody Allen's 1977 classic Annie Hall.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill Mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know, and such small portions."
While the film's overall costume design was the work of Ruth Morley, with a little help from Ralph Lauren, its most famous outfit actually came from the personal wardrobe of the film's star, Diane Keaton, who has, of course, carried the style through decades in various incarnations. At position number three, it's Tim Burton's second appearance in this list, with 1992's Batman Returns. And while Michael Keaton's Batsuit certainly set a whole new standard, it's actually Michelle Pfeiffer who steals the show here with her incredible performance as Catwoman.
Always waiting for some Batman to save you. I am Catwoman. Hear me roar.
In the words of Italian fashion journalist Anna Del Russo, fashion is always uncomfortable. If you feel comfortable, you never get the look. And as Batman's feline Fatale, Pfeiffer lived that philosophy perhaps a little too literally. Climbing inside the skin-tight outfit every day required a process a little bit like vacuum packing a cut of meat. She was covered in powder, sealed inside, then covered in a silicone finish to achieve that glistening shine. The result is surely one of the greatest costumes ever put on the screen, but it was perhaps also one of the most impractical. In fact, Michelle Pfeiffer found it so unbearable that some sources cite it as one of the reasons she declined to reprise the role in her own spin-off movie. Though, considering Tim Burton was soon ousted as director in favour of Joel Schumacher, with the next two films proving critical disasters, that's probably for the best. We won't even mention that Halle Berry version. In second place, we take things right back to basics in 1951's A Streetcar Named Desire.
Hey, Stella!
It's been nearly 70 years since Marlon Brando showed everyone how to wear a t-shirt, and still, no one has quite perfected it the way he did in Ilya Kazan's masterpiece. T-shirt became a term in American English sometime around the 1920s, but it wasn't until the post-Second World War era that it graduated from undergarment to symbol of youthful rebellion, worn proudly on the outside. Stroll any fashion district today and you'll surely spot someone adapting elements of Brando's simple mastery. And at number one, well, how could we go past Funny Face?
A magazine must be like a human being. If it comes into the home, it must contribute. It just can't lie around. A magazine must have blood and brains and bazazz. This is just paper.
Audrey Hepburn's classic musical from 1957 is perhaps the quintessential fashion film. And with Hollywood's greatest ever costume designer, Edith Head, and gowns by Hubert de Givenchy, it's little wonder that it consistently holds its place up there with the best. Head designed costumes for just about all of Hollywood's legends, winning a record 8 Academy Awards. But she perhaps has the most fun in Funny Face, with the film's story of a reluctant intellectual drawn into a fashion career in Paris, giving her ample room to craft an almost limitless wardrobe of high fashion. Well, that's all for this edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. It was edited and mixed by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. I'm Ben Rylan. We'll catch you next time.